And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. Want to invite you to have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to take some notes, names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, that kind of thing, so that you can take action. This is Thursday, March 24th. Let's start with announcements. The Elliott Rainforest Climbing Camp will happen from April 19th to the 24th up in Oregon. In this story from the Earth First Newswire, did you ever dream of exploring the forest canopy, sleeping in the trees, or dangling from bridges? Would you like to join Blockadia or create Blockadia in your hometown? Join us in the Elliott Rainforest from April 19th through the 24th for a week of intensive training and climbing in the backwoods of Southwestern Oregon. They're asking for an online registration so that they can send you directions and make sure they have enough gear for everyone. You're welcome to use a nickname if you don't want people to know everything about you. We're capping registration at 25 to 30 participants and prioritizing people who can commit to training for the entire week. You might also be able to take on more people if you're coming with substantial experience and can help with basic training. Please contact us if you can do this. We'll also have some basic policies about substance abuse, probably not any substance abuse, liability waivers, darn those lawyers, and we'll update you on when that we send you the directions. We'll have a communal kitchen with enough taters so that no one goes hungry, but we'd love it if you'd bring some food to share and snack on. Your kids are more than welcome at this event, and you'll have to be there, of course. And we will be over 45 minutes from stores and hospitals, so plan accordingly. Dogs are fine as long as they can handle you climbing in the trees without biting the trainers or digging in the shitter or terrorizing the small kids. We're holding this camp in the spring so that we can climb without interfering with nesting marbled murrelets, the coolest birds ever. The Elliott is a rainforest, so come prepared to camp and climb in the rain. You'll need rain jackets, rain pants, multiple pairs of wool socks, and a tent with a good rain fly are all recommended. We'll bring some dry firewood and hella tarps. We're asking for a $30 to $100 donation per participant to help bring trainers out and buy food and equipment. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. For more information and to register, email ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com. Once again, that's ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com. And if you want for more information, you can try the Earth First Journal Newswire. And let's start off with the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. It gives us great pleasure to share some incredibly positive news with you. 2 days after the heartbreaking media tour of Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Trap Capture Facility, where 150 wild buffalo were processed and shipped to slaughter or otherwise condemned to death, the bulk of the trap was empty and Yellowstone was hungry to capture more bison. Haunted by what we had witnessed there, our hearts sank as large groups of buffalo approached the trap. As expected, Yellowstone Park wranglers, those who work at the trap, attempted to capture these buffalo families. First, they went after a group of 72 buffalo, then another group of 30. In a beautiful twist of fate, the buffalo sensed the danger and were determined to save themselves from slaughter. As of this writing, there are no other captures at Stevens Creek. So 57 orphan calves and yearlings remain captive, with Yellowstone telling us that they don't know how long they'll be held or what their fate will be. There are currently no other buffalo near the trap, though the Park Service intends to keep it open through the end of March. Thankfully, the majority of buffalo have left the Gardner Basin. West of Yellowstone in the Hebgen Basin, spring migration is beginning. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have been extremely busy from early in the morning through late at night, warning traffic of buffalo along the highways. They are attempting to migrate to their favorite traditional campgrounds on Horse Butte, but there is still a lot of snow to negotiate. We've had some very warm days and extremely cold nights, so the snow is like concrete and difficult for the buffalo to navigate or forage through. Their best chances for food are along the south-facing slopes and the river and creek beds where grass is slowly starting to become exposed. It's a very difficult time for the buffalo and all wildlife, having survived one of the harshest winters in the lower 48 states and having all their fat stores used up, and with the earth providing very little nutrition as of yet. But buffalo are strong survivors, and they will come, bringing the next generation. While buffalo should be safe on Horse Butte thanks to Governor Steve Bullock's decision to grant some year-round habitat, but we will not know for sure until the decision is accepted and or not at the next Interagency Bison Management Plan meeting on April 6th in West Yellowstone, and until we see how the Montana Department of Livestock interprets that decision. The Buffalo and the Buffalo Field Campaign need your assistance right now. Many of the volunteers who have been with us all winter will be leaving soon due to spring commitments. We are losing a fair number of people just as our busy season begins. If you have the time and desire, please consider volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign. They provide room, board, gear, and training for all their volunteers. All you need to do is get there. They do ask for a minimum volunteer time, so make sure you have some time to help the buffalo. Go to their volunteer pages on their webpage to learn more, and by all means, do give them a call before you go. You can reach the Buffalo Field Campaign at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. That webpage again, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. In addition to volunteering, they have a needs list, so check that out. And if you need to send anything, including money, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That's Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And once again, the webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And turning to Europe, wild bison have been reintroduced into the Netherlands in this story from the Earth First Newswire, written by Brian Clark Howard of National Geographic. European bison went extinct in the wild in 1919, but now a few thousand are back, grazing in forests and on plains in a handful of countries. The first four of a group of 11 animals, Europe's largest living land animals, were reintroduced into state forest land in the Netherlands earlier this month. The Dutch government hopes the carefully bred and selected animals, 3 bulls and 8 cows, will multiply. Fenced inside an area of about 1,500 hectares, or 3,000 acres in the southeastern province of Noord-Brabant, the European bison herd will eventually serve as a breeding stock to supply efforts to rewild other parts of the continent, says Frans Scheppers, the managing director of the Netherlands-based nonprofit Rewilding Europe. The group oversees the breeding of the bison based on the animals that lived in zoos after they were wiped out in the wild. This latest project marks the second reintroduction of bison into the Netherlands, with the first taking place on the Kranswal Nature Preserve in the province of Noord-Holland in 2007. The species has been selected for such rewilding efforts because of the important role it plays in establishing the ecosystem of Europe's forests and plains, Shepherd noted. Rewilding is not just about putting animals back, he said. It's about allowing natural processes to take over as much as possible. Bison serve important roles such as cropping and fertilizing grasses, which then become food for deer and many other animals. Bison also serve as important food sources for wolves and other predators and for vultures when they die. That's why Rewilding Europe and other partners have been slowly reintroducing bison into pockets of Europe over the past few years. Out of about 5,000 of the animals left on the continent, about 3,500 now live in wild or semi-wild places. The largest herds are in Poland and Romania, but scientists hope they can gain footholds in other areas. As of now, there are more wild black rhinos in Africa than there are wild bison in Europe. Other keystone species being similarly targeted for reintroduction include beaver, which shape wetlands, red deer and wild horses, which shape forests and plains, or even extinct urochs, the wild predecessors of modern domestic cattle. To shepherds, such efforts are not about bringing back the past. Our point of reference is oriented toward the future, he added. People have influenced nature, so what we look for are the key species that used to be in the area that can shape this new landscape in a modern context. To bring back aurochs, scientists have been backbreeding old lines of domestic cattle. Aurochs went extinct in the mid-1600s, so there are many accurate drawings of what the animals looked like as well as physical remains. By taking the cattle that are most genetically similar to aurochs and breeding them for traits that are more like their ancestors, scientists are getting animals that look like the originals, said Sheppers. Such projects could be sustainably supported by jobs in tourists and natural products, auric leather, anyone, as well as through government protection. Still, challenges remain. The populations of many animals being reintroduced were so devastated that not a lot of genetic diversity remains. Scientists are working hard to maximize what they have by careful pairings and management, but the animals still may prove to be susceptible to diseases and other problems of inbreeding. And as predators like wolves and bears slowly return to the continent, clashes with people are likely to increase. At the same time, the fact that people are increasingly moving to cities has meant more land is opening up in the countryside, ripe for rewilding. That's as long as the neighbors don't object too much, as ranchers do around Yellowstone when wolves or bison stray onto their land. The ultimate goal of introducing bison and other animals is to make wild nature a normal part of modern Europe, said Sheppers. With only about 1% of the continent's land currently in a state of wild wilderness, Rewilding Europe and other partners have their work cut out. The good news, they say, is that they don't have to achieve pristine wilderness to be successful. Any step towards something more natural is better than more degraded landscape that came before. And if you want further information, go to the Earth First Journal Newswire. And in some breaking news, Tyler Lang, who was sentenced to time served for freeing 2,000 mink, has been released. From the Support Kevin and Tyler webpage, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On March 23rd, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, animal rights Tyler Lang was sentenced to 3 months' time served. He has 6 months of home imprisonment left, 6 months of community confinement, and 1 year of supervised release, along with a $200,000 restitution. This sentence is for freeing 2,000 mink from a fur farm and spray painting "Liberation is Love" on the side of a barn with his co-defendant Kevin Johnson. The fur farm closed down as a result of the action. In 2014, when Lang and Johnson were indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act for the mink liberation in Morris, Illinois. During the summer of 2015, Lang and Johnson entered the non-cooperating plea agreements through which they pled guilty to violating the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. On February 29, 2016, Johnson was sentenced to 3 years. The public has grown increasingly skeptical of charging people with terrorism for saving animals from living in barren wired cages on fur farms and then being killed by methods that include anal electrocution or having their necks snapped. During Johnson's sentencing, even Assistant U.S. Attorney Bethany K. Bisenthal described his intentions as noble, and today she described Tyler's beliefs as a very noble cause. Skepticism surrounding the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act stems from its origin. It was crafted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, a group of corporate power players who write pieces of model legislation that suit the interests or the interests of the corporations they support. And then ALEC passes off the legislation to members of Congress. Many members of ALEC are part of the pharmaceutical, big ag, and other industries that exploit and kill animals for profit. ALEC devised the ATA, legislation not meant so much for prosecuting activists. Lang and Johnson are among only a handful of people who've ever been charged under the act, but to conjure public fear of the animal liberation movement and chill dissent. Tyler and Kevin's case should be a reminder to us all that we have to show each other love and support in the face of state repression. One of the best ways of responses we can have is to take care of each other and continue to work for a day in which no animals are confined to cages or killed for profit. And you can find further information at the Earth First Newswire. And a tree sit has been launched to stop fracked gas pipeline in Vermont, in this story from Rising Tide Vermont, as found on the Earth First Newswire. From Moncton, Vermont, vowing to stay aloft until construction is halted, climate justice activists have launched an aerial blockade directly in the path of a fracked gas pipeline on Rotax Road. An activist with Rising Tide Vermont is currently suspended on a tree platform 30 feet above the ground, preventing the tree from being cut down and blocking the right-of-way for pipeline construction. This story was posted on March 22nd, so I don't know if there's any updates. Moncton residents and Vermonters from across the state have used every available legal channel to speak out against this pipeline for the past 3 years, said Moncton resident Jane Palmer. Our voices have not been heard and the public good has not been respected, and at this point it is no surprise that people are putting their bodies on the line to halt this fracked gas nightmare, Palmer said. The aerial blockade was launched at 6:30 in the morning in advance of crews slated to clear this portion of the pipeline route later in the day. As pipeline construction ramps up this spring, we will continue to take direct action, said Will Bennington, a spokesperson for Rising Tide Vermont. We won't back down, and we're asking anyone who agrees with us that fracked gas is a climate disaster, so come on down and join us. And you can find further information about this story on the Earth First Newswire. And a Native American tribe is slated to relocate from Louisiana coast as sea levels rise, in this story written by Sebastian Malo with editing by Ross Russell, as found on World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A small Native American community in coastal Louisiana is to be resettled after losing nearly all of its land, partly due to rising seas, a first in the United States. The band of Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw, a Native American tribe living in Louisiana coastal wetlands, has lost some 98% of its land since the 1950s. This is the first time an entire community has had to be relocated, due in part to rising sea levels, said Marion McFadden, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The land loss is also due to factors such as erosion and sediment mismanagement, a Louisiana official has said. The band of Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw have lived and fished on the Isle de Jean Charles in Louisiana's south coast since the 1800s, a tribal spokesman said. But land loss has caused the island to shrink from some 15,000 acres to a strip about a quarter mile wide by a half mile long, a study by Northern Arizona University has shown. From a peak of 400 inhabitants, about only 100 remain. The loss of land to the sea and houses to hurricanes have caused families to leave, said Boyo Billiot, the tribe's deputy chief, in a telephone conversation to reporters. No one likes to leave an area where they have history and a lot of memories, said Billiot. We have people of the bayou. Water has played a central role in who we are. Climate advocacy group Climate Nexus said the relocation of the tribe was creating new refugees of climate change, but Louisiana and the federal government officials offered a different interpretation. We really don't think of the community as refugees. I think of refugees as being scattered in chaotic retreat. This is a resettlement, and we are careful to use that word, said Patrick Forbes, a Louisiana state official. The relocation would be subsidized by about a $48 million government fund, said Forbes, and would take a few years to complete. The Louisiana coast has been sinking at a fast pace compared to most U.S. coastal areas, a phenomenon officials attribute to sea level rise, but also due to erosion. Sea levels have already risen by some 8 inches in coastal Louisiana over the last 50 years. According to a 2014 U.S. government report, as global sea levels continue to rise, relative sea level rises will be greater along some coasts, such as Louisiana and Texas. The continuous decline of the band of Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw population has been threatened by the tribe's ancestral traditions, including those related to fishing, such as the weaving of catch nets. As the people leave out, culture goes with it, said Billiot, reflecting on the tribe's attachment to Ile Jean Charles. He recalled his late grandfather's prophetic words. He said, "The people will have to leave from the island," and he said, you all don't disturb the dead that are buried there, because now a lot are in the water where the graves are at. And turning to the southern oceans, in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in Australia, Japanese whalers have returned from their Antarctic slaughter. The Australian and New Zealand governments have failed to protect the whales. In a statement released today, the Institute for Cetacean Research, a body behind the Japanese government's whaling program, announced the return of the Japanese whaling fleet from its annual Antarctic slaughter. It is the first time the Japanese whalers have returned to the Southern Ocean to slaughter whales since the International Court of Justice ruled its whaling program was illegal in 2014. The statement confirmed that 333 whales, including a number of pregnant females, have been harpooned in Antarctic water by Japanese whalers since December. Specifically, the coordinates provided indicate the slaughters occurred within the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary, the Australian Whale Sanctuary, and the Ross Sea. CEO of Sea Shepherd Global, Captain Alex Cornelison, said just a year and a half after the International Court of Justice ruled Japan's whaling program to be illegal, and just months after the Australian Federal Court ordered the whalers to pay a $1 million fine for illegally slaughtering whales inside the Australian Whale Sanctuary, the Japanese government has sanctioned yet another mass slaughter of protected minke whales in the Southern Ocean. This rogue act is in blatant disregard of international law and diplomacy and sets a dangerous precedent for all nations that respect the rule of law. Once again, the false promises from the Australian and New Zealand governments have resulted in whales being killed illegally in the Australian Whale Sanctuary, said Sea Shepherd Australia Managing Director Jeff Hansen. The majority of Australians want Australian government to send a vessel to oppose the slaughter, but they did not. Sea Shepherd requested that the Australian government release the location of the whalers. They refused. Instead, the governments responsible for protecting these magnificent creatures stood by in the complete knowledge that both federal and international crimes were taking place. The empty response from authorities in the wake of the International Court of Justice ruling is a disgrace, Hansen said. The chair of the Sea Shepherd Australia Board of Directors, Captain Peter Hammerstedt, said Sea Shepherd was handicapped by the new ICR strategy of expanding their area of operations and reducing their quota, meaning that the time required to locate them within the expanded zone made intervention extremely difficult with the ships that Sea Shepherd is able to deploy. Sea Shepherd felt that this was an opportunity for the world's governments to demonstrate some resolve to uphold international conservation law. The Australian and New Zealand governments did nothing, and this has served to illustrate that the only thing that has proven effective against illegal Japanese whaling fleet has been the interventions of Sea Shepherd. Sea Shepherd will soon have a fast, long-range ship, and more importantly, Sea Shepherd has something that the Australian and New Zealand governments lack, and that is courage and passion, and the resolve to uphold the law, he concluded. And five more bald eagles have been found killed in Delaware in this story by Victoria Cavalier, with editing by Paul Tate, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Five bald eagles have died in Delaware, state officials said on Tuesday, after 13 of the U.S. national birds were determined to have been killed by humans in neighboring Maryland. The Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control said it was investigating what killed the eagles, but would not comment publicly on possible causes. Three of the eagles were still alive and very ill when they were discovered on the weekend. Sergeant Don McDerby of the Delaware Fish and Wildlife Natural Resources said in a statement they died a short time after their rescue. We don't know how many eagles may have been affected, so we are asking the public to notify us immediately if they should see birds that appear sick, McDerby said. 13 bald eagles were discovered dead in Maryland last month, as reported here on the Earth First Update, with lab results indicating the birds did not die of natural causes, including diseases such as avian influenza, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The agency declined to state whether the birds were poisoned, but said the investigation was focusing on humans as the cause of death. the 13 birds represented in Maryland's largest bald eagle die-off in 30 years, officials said. The bald eagle, which had almost disappeared from the United States decades ago, was removed from the federal endangered species list in 2007 after habitat protection and the banning of the pesticide DDT led to its recovery. The federally protected bird is a symbol of the U.S. government and is found on our currency and in the presidential seal. The maximum fine for harming a bald eagle is $100,000 and a year in jail. And there's been a record number of West Coast entanglements for humpbacks. A proposed plan by the National Marine Fisheries Service for monitoring humpback whales ignores one of the fastest growing threats to the iconic species, entanglement in fishing gear. Along the West Coast, a record 31 humpback whales were caught in fishing gear in 2015, according to new federal data. The draft plan is required before the Fisheries Service can finalize its proposal to remove Endangered Species Act protection from most of the populations of humpback whales. But in 2015, entanglement numbers were more than twice what they were last year in 2014. Dragging heavy fishing gear can injure or kill the whales by draining their energy and cutting into their flesh. Humpbacks are recovering thanks to the power of the Endangered Species Act, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Kristen Monsell. But the job isn't done. Entanglement in fishing gear is one of several serious and growing threats these whales face, so it's premature to end these protections now. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. You can tune into Free Radio tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. for a rebroadcast of this Earth First Update. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune into KRFP 90.3 FM Radio Free Moscow at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays for the Earth First Update. Or in Boston, tune into WZBC Boston, Massachusetts Truth and Justice Radio Broadcasting on 90.3 FM, and you can hear the Earth First Update sometime between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. You can also tune in on the Internet to Grateful Dread Public Radio, an Internet radio station. Their webpage is gdprnashville.org, that's gdprnashville.org, and you can hear the Earth First Update on Sunday at 2 a.m., and you can also find them on tunein.com and spotify.com. Or you could go to radioforall.net, where you could listen online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to download and air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.